You're listening to Central Time here on the Ideas Network. I'm Rob Ferret. Coming up, find out how an animal archive at UW's Zoological Museum could help save some endangered snakes. Now this week, the Food and Drug Administration will have a new verdict on vaping and e-cigarettes. The agency has imposed regulations on the industry in the past, including banning the sale of 50,000 different flavored vape products. Now the FDA will decide whether e-cigarettes and related products meet the standards of being safe for those consumers who already use them and for not being appealing to non-smokers. We're talking about potential new regulations on vaping products, and you could join in at 800-642-1234. How, if at all, do you think vapes and e-cigarettes should be regulated? Should they have similar regulations to regular cigarettes and other traditional tobacco products? Have you switched from cigarettes to some kind of vaping product yourself? Do you think flavors should be on the table? Call 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234. Or post on the Ideas Network Facebook page. Doug Jorenby is Director of Clinical Services for the UW Center for Tobacco Research and Intervention. He's a clinical psychologist and professor of medicine at the UW-Madison School of Medicine and Public Health. Dr. Jorenby, welcome back to Central Time.
Hi. It's a pleasure to be able to join you today.
I want to start off by talking about this process and what's at stake. It's a little complicated because it's not just a ruling coming down on all vaping products. It's a lot of applications, as I understand it, from a lot of different companies. What's going on here?
Yeah, and you really didn't overstate that. The FDA got somewhere in the order of 6.5 million of these applications, which is basically permission to market non-traditional tobacco products. So anything that was out there on the market before the 15th of February in 2007 is grandfathered, but everything since then just opens up a whole realm of new devices and versions of e-juice, and I don't think anyone actually believes that they're going to be rendering decisions about all 6.5 million of those products as of tomorrow, but they do seem to be prioritizing a number of them.
What are those priorities? Are they the bigger names on the market, for example?
That's basically what they've been hinting. You mentioned in your introduction that, you know, near the end of August here, they actually issued 55,000 denials, which were kind of the low-hanging fruit. You know, those were the applications that were incomplete, that didn't have data to accompany them. And for the most part, they were flavors of e-juice that have really been set aside as marketing almost exclusively to young people who were not already tobacco users. And that's one of the priorities of things that they don't want to have on the market.
What kind of things is the FDA weighing as they evaluate each one of these seven-digit number of products, these millions of products?
Yeah, it's an awful lot of work. So the overarching priority they have, not surprisingly, given that it's the Food and Drug Administration, but they're looking at it in the context of protecting public health. And the way that's being implemented in more concrete terms are, first of all, they're looking for evidence, and it's evidence, not just assertion, that products that will be authorized for sale will help people who are currently using traditional tobacco products to quit, whether that means, you know, quitting nicotine entirely, whether it means transitioning to a lower risk kind of delivery system, which is what some people have described e-cigarettes as, that's not as clearly defined. They're also looking very closely, and this is where the denials from the end of August come in. They don't want to approve anything that is going to increase the uptake of nicotine or tobacco products. And they're specifically, they're looking at younger populations. And then finally, kind of in their, you know, their traditional remit, they're also looking for evidence that the methods used to produce these things, the ingredients, the manufacturing processes are safe and reliable. So it's a compilation of those three different factors.
Talking to Dr. Doug Jorenby from the UW Center for Tobacco Research and Intervention. We're talking about e-cigarettes and vaping, the FDA reviewing millions of applications. trying to decide whether to allow products to be sold, marketed, figure out if they are safe, if they help people quit smoking traditional tobacco products, and at the same time, are they luring kids into using nicotine in the first place? You can join in at 800-642-1234. What do you want to see, if anything, from the FDA here? Do you use vaping products yourself? What's your experience been like? Are you in the business? Are you worried about what's coming out, maybe in the next few days? Call in with your thoughts and questions at 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234, or email ideas@WPR.org. Dr. Jordanby, let's take a couple of the different pieces of the puzzle here, starting with vaping by people who used to smoke cigarettes. What do we know about comparative risk for that regular, say, cigarette smoker who switches over to regular e-cigarette use?
In exactly the terms that you described, that's really a no-brainer. Because if you look at a traditional cigarette, when it's used the way it's intended, you know, regular daily smokers, we know from actually now almost a century of experience that that's going to end up killing about 1 in 2 users of traditional cigarettes. So, you know, by comparison, you're setting the bar extraordinarily low. Mm-hmm. Initially, it really seemed like e-cigarettes were going to be just, you know, in a completely different realm. We knew they didn't have carbon monoxide in them, which is one of the dangerous things people inhale from burning tobacco. We knew that it was going to have less than the hundreds of, you know, cancer-causing agents that's in tobacco smoke. Unfortunately, as we've been playing catch-up with this, you know, scientifically and in terms of treatment, we've found that it's a lower risk when people are vaping. But there's a couple big qualifiers there. One is that there are some health risks that do seem to be specific to vaping, you know, whether it's particulates that are drawn down into the lungs, whether it's metals that come from the atomization of the vapor that pose their own risks. I think more to the point, though, we've also discovered that in the real world, while switching to e-cigarettes seems really appealing to a lot of people who are smoking, what actually happens in a large number of cases is instead of quitting smoking completely and transitioning to vaping or quitting both altogether, people end up betwixt and between. They're what we call dual users. So some of the time they vape and some of the time they smoke. And we don't have long-term data on that, but at this point in the short to medium term, it seems like smoking some of the time doesn't really reduce people's risk all that much. So it is, as much as people like to throw the term harm reduction around, if someone is a dual user, it doesn't look like there's a whole lot of harm being reduced at this point.
All right, now let's move over to a different bar here and compare what we know about e-cigarettes to smoking cessation products that have been tested and approved, the gums and the patches and things like that. What do we know about how those stack up against e-cigarettes?
Right. Well, we know for the most part that they're more effective in helping people quit smoking completely. That's what they're designed to do.
The gums and patches I mentioned are more effective than the e-cigarettes, just to clarify.
Yes. Okay. Yes. They certainly have a much larger base of evidence. Really, at this point, there's only one really well-designed, you know, adequately powered study looking at nicotine replacement and smoking cessation treatments versus e-cigarettes. And that one was actually done in the United Kingdom, so it's not directly comparable. But with the smoking cessation therapies that are all FDA approved, with those, we have anywhere from decades to at the short end, probably about 15, 20 years of evidence of them being safe and effective when used as directed.
We're talking to Dr. Doug Jordanby, Director of Clinical Services for the UW Center for Tobacco Research and Intervention. He's talked to us about vaping and e-cigarettes and some big rulings on the way from the FDA on millions of vaping products. And you can join in at 800-642-1234. Would you like to see the FDA crack down a lot on e-cigarette products or keep a light touch on the industry? Do you want to see more research into e-cigarettes and their risks, their possible benefits as compared to cigarettes. Still a lot of questions open. Do you want to see bans on flavored vaping products? That the concern is, we'll talk about this more, that they may appeal to kids and get them to try nicotine for the first time. Call 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234. You can also post on the Ideas Network Facebook page. We'll continue the conversation coming up on Central Time. This is Central Time. I'm Rob Verrett. We continue our conversation with Dr. Doug Jornby from the Center for Tobacco Research and Intervention at the UW, looking at rulings coming maybe very soon from the FDA on a long list of vaping products. You can join in at 800-642-1234 with your thoughts on vaping, what kind of regulation you do or don't want to see, your questions about e-cigarettes. That's 800-642-1234. Before we go to our calls, Dr. Jornby, though, I want to ask about the kid angle here, the concern that there are flavors and products that are all but marketed toward kids, the risk of bringing them into nicotine use in the first place. How does the FDA weigh those considerations?
Well, that's definitely one of the key criteria that they're looking at in deciding, you know, which products will be allowed on the market following these decisions that will start rolling out tomorrow. They've already taken steps. So the most obvious example is the Juul products, the pods that contain nicotine salts. When that was somewhere in the realm of 70 to 80% of the market, their most popular flavors of that included things like mango, cream, and fruit. And they saw which way the wind was blowing and got out just moments ahead of the FDA banning a lot of the fruit and candy flavored. So they brought that down so that they were only offering tobacco and menthol and mint. And then, you know, the FDA said, nope, mint is not on the table at all. So that went away. And there's really solid reasons for that. We know now from some population studies, the first done in California, looking at a very small, large sample of young people, that among those who had never smoked at all, teenagers who started vaping were on the order of 2 to 3 times more likely to then go on and start smoking traditional tobacco cigarettes. And that's been a finding that's been replicated in different populations since then. So it's a pretty significant risk factor.
Let's bring on a caller now at 800-642-1234. Nick is on the line in Green Bay. Nick, hi.
Hi, I'm pretty spiteful towards the tobacco companies. I'm very spiteful towards them. I didn't have a dad growing up. My uncle was my life. He was just amazing. He smoked since he was 6 years old. He tried the vaping he said it was less dangerous. Well, about 2 years ago, he passed away. He's only 10 years older than that. My world just was destroyed. These tobacco companies are just terrible. They're just vultures preying on kids and stuff with all these stupid flavors and stuff. It's just ridiculous. I wish people could have been there when my uncle passed away with me and seen the damage that tobacco and all that stuff does to people. I'm devastated yet. It's been 2 years.
Nick, thank you for sharing that story. I'm so sorry for your loss. Dr. Jornby, Nick, putting a human face there on what we see in statistical terms a lot of times.
Yeah, absolutely. And it's important to not lose sight of, you know, the individuals involved. And I'm really sorry to hear that you lost your uncle as well. And it's also important to realize, too, that there's not a bright dividing line between this. All of the traditional tobacco companies they already have and are moving forward with different, you know, vaping, e-cigarette, or sometimes what are called heat don't burn products. So they've seen the writing on the wall as well, and they're trying to secure a chunk of that market going forward.
Thanks again for that call. We'll go now to Donna in Madison. Donna, hi.
Hi. I want to thank you for having this subject on your station. It is well needed. There are too many young people that this is attracting them, that it's cool to be doing vaping, and they refuse to listen to people that have knowledge about the damages of vaping and smoking, etc. And thank you again very much for putting this show on about the subject.
Donna, thanks a lot for that call. And Dr. Jornby, what do we know about the health impacts, especially of vaping on younger users, on people who start maybe in high school or even middle school?
Well, we know that they're at increased risk when they start that young to continue using nicotine throughout their life. At this point, it's hard to say whether that is automatically going to translate into smoking later. But unfortunately, and this has almost disappeared from, you know, awareness, given what we've been dealing with the COVID pandemic in the last year and a half. But shortly before that, we actually had a very striking example of young people who were put at immediate risk and unfortunately in many cases lost their lives from vaping, essentially, you know, contraband market products, most of which contained THC, sometimes with nicotine, sometimes without. But these were not, you know, products that were sold over the counter commercially. But the technology of vaping and e-cigarettes is pretty agnostic as to, you know, what's in the cartridge, what's in the fluid. And these contaminations resulted in a number of young people ending up in, you know, intensive care units and unfortunately in many cases dying because they were vaping contaminated products.
Thanks again for that call at 800-642-1234. Talking to Dr. Doug Jornby with the UW Center for Tobacco Research and Intervention, looking at the FBA's review of millions of e-cigarette and vaping-related products and maybe changes in how they're regulated. We'll be finding out over the next few days. Back to your calls now. We've got Mark on the line, on the road. Mark, hi.
Hi, how you doing? Thanks for taking my call. I just got a quick question here. Hopefully you can hear me okay. I'm an over-the-road driver, so it might be kind of loud.
I hear you loud and clear, Mark. Go ahead.
Awesome. So I'm a longtime cigarette smoker myself, and I guess my question is, so I've recently kind of dabbled into the Juul, and I noticed that I don't use it as often as I would like smoking cigarettes. Is there a misconception that the tobacco cigarettes might be, I get both are bad for you, but might be better because it's more organic versus the 100% chemical makeup of something like an e-cigarette.
Mark, thanks a lot for the call. So Dr. Jornby, he's concerned about the chemicals in Juul, but I know there are concerns about cigarette products not just being a tobacco plant.
Yeah, absolutely. And it's almost impossible to find a traditional cigarette that is just tobacco. It's not just that they're, you know, cured and processed, but there are substances added to them, such as ammonia, that increase the bioavailability of the nicotine and, you know, get people hooked on that more readily. The biggest risk factor, though, you know, in the comparison Mark was making between a traditional cigarette and an e-cigarette, isn't so much about the chemical compound, it's what happens when we burn. When you burn tobacco, that combustion creates a whole new realm of, you know, dangerous substances, things that are hard on the lungs, on the cardiovascular system in the body. And that's where most of the excess risk comes from. So to the extent that e-cigarettes are, I'm not going to say safe, but are less hazardous to people, it's because combustion isn't taking place. It's just the aerosol that's being created, and that's what people are inhaling into their lungs.
Mark, thanks for that call. And Dr. Jornby, this is right up your alley at the Center for Tobacco Research and Intervention. Mark's in this situation. He smokes. He's obviously concerned about the health impact. Where would you suggest he start with efforts to try to kick the habit? And I know it's tough. I know it can take multiple tries.
It absolutely is. And, you know, doing a dangerous job like driving truck over the road where you got to stay focused sometimes under very bad conditions. I can totally understand where, you know, it helps him focus. He doesn't want to be distracted and going through the kind of things that people do when they're quitting cold turkey with nicotine withdrawal. We do, though, have a whole range of different evidence-based treatments that help reduce the withdrawal symptoms, that help reduce the craving. And what I would encourage Mark or anyone else in that situation thinking about quitting is, you know, reach out to your healthcare providers. We've got treatments now that are readily available. They're all covered under the Affordable Care Act at no cost to people because they're considered preventive care. And these double or triple people's chances of success. And that is without any of the risks that have been identified with people vaping. So that would definitely be a great place to start for anyone who's thinking seriously about getting tobacco out of their life.
Mark, thanks for that call. Good luck to you. Time for one more call. Ellen is with us in Birchwood. Ellen, hi.
Hi, I'm a nicotine dependence counselor, and I just wanted to add that, you know, kids are more addictive, you know, under age 25. So when they use these flavors, I mean, that's how they're getting, you know, these kids with hooking them, you know, in this addictive time of their life. And it's just super unfortunate. I hope these flavors don't go through.
Ellen, thanks for the call and sharing your expertise. Dr. Jornby, kids vulnerable to addiction if they start these products.
Yeah, absolutely. You know, we've identified some genetic variants that if people start using nicotine before the age of 16, the chance of them becoming dependent and the difficulty they have quitting later on goes up dramatically. And I agree with Ellen, you know, some of those fruit flavors, the candy flavors, they're definitely aimed at young people. And what's shocking is a lot of them, when they're interviewed, don't even realize that there's nicotine in the products. They're focused on the flavor. They're focused on the taste of or the process of vaping to fit in, and don't even realize that they're taking in nicotine until they've developed a dependence on it. And, you know, then it's a real challenge to get that out of their lives.
Dr. Jornby, we'll leave it there. Thanks again for joining us today.
Oh, it was a pleasure. Thanks for having me.
That's Dr. Doug Jornby, Director of Clinical Services for the UW Center for Tobacco Research and Intervention. He's a clinical psychologist and professor of medicine at the UW School of Medicine and Public Health. He joined us for a look at e-cigarettes and vaping and new rulings rolling out, maybe starting by the end of this week, from the FDA on a long list of vaping-related products. Now, when you're trying to solve a mystery, a time machine could really come in handy. But we don't have time machines. Not yet, anyway. But for a biological mystery, Wisconsin has the next best thing. A researcher turned to the biological archives at the University of Wisconsin Zoological Museum to answer questions about a threat to an endangered snake species. Laura Monahan is a curator of collections at UW Zoological Museum. Laura, welcome to Central Time.
Thank you.
And Jeff Lorch is a microbiologist with the U.S. Geological Survey's National Wildlife Health Center in Madison. Jeff, thanks for joining us today.
Thanks for having me.
Well, before we get to the snakes here, I want to check out the archive. Laura, I know I stole the time machine metaphor from you. I apologize. Tell us about the this archive, in effect, of biology at your museum.
Well, we have about 750,000 specimens on the fourth floor in the basement of Nolan Hall. It's in a classroom building. And we collect birds, mammals, reptiles, amphibians, fishes, some aquatic invertebrates, and we prepare them to keep in the collection and make them available for researchers like Dr. Lorch.
And how far back does your collection go, time-wise?
The collection was started in the 1840s, and we have specimens that go back almost that far.
Okay, Jeff, so in your research, you had cause to go searching through the archives for some specimens. Can you tell us about the research and what you were after?
Yeah, so this disease, snake fungal disease, sort of first got noticed in 2008, and we were curious to know if the disease, the fungus that causes the disease, was introduced around that time, or if it had been present for a long time and we just sort of began to notice it around 2008.
And what did you find when you started digging through the archives looking at these preserved snakes from decades ago?
Yeah, so we looked at over 500 specimens in museum collections, and what we found is that at least 10% of snakes that we examined had what superficially looked like this disease, and we're able to actually confirm it in specimens going back as early as 1945.
Laura, that makes me think about how you preserve a specimen like this. Not only a snake, you know, and keeping it intact so people can go and look at it later, but also keeping that fungus there, but also not letting that fungus keep growing and destroying the rest of the sample. How challenging is it to preserve things that accurately?
Well, different specimens are preserved in different ways. So the snakes that Dr. Lorch was looking at are preserved in ethanol in jars. And then we have other specimens that are preserved as skins and then skeletons as well. So it depends on the type of animal that comes in and how it is eventually preserved.
And could you talk a little more, Laura, about the variety of kinds of research that people come and want to dig through your archives to find past examples of our animal life?
So we have some researchers who are just looking at morphology. They're just looking at some of the variation that we can see between specimens. Sometimes we send specimens to be analyzed for DNA. And we have a lot of students and faculty who use the specimens here for research projects that they're doing on campus related to their course studies or theses, dissertations.
Jeff, can you talk about the value of having that this older evidence of this fungus for this particular kind of snake and how it helps you understand the kind of threat that this fungus represents?
Yeah, so it's really hard when you try to do disease investigations and try to answer these questions because we often don't have a lot of historical samples saved. So we do turn to museum collections, and this has been done with actually quite a few other wildlife diseases as well. And the reason we care about when a disease is introduced is because it often affects both the impacts that the disease can have, but also how we would manage for the disease. So for example, if a pathogen is introduced, often in areas where it is introduced, the host species have never seen that pathogen before, so they're much more susceptible, and you can have pretty high mortality in a population that gets exposed. And then from a management perspective, something that's new or introduced, we might focus on trying to contain the disease so that it doesn't spread further, versus something that's been here much longer, we might be looking at how we can influence certain environmental factors, for example, that might sort of make the snakes be more healthy and able to fend off the infection more effectively.
Now, Laura, when a researcher comes in looking for something like, say, snakes with fungus, I'm trying to get my head around how it actually works. Do they thumb through a card catalog, or how do they find, and how do you help them find what they're looking for?
Well, in this case, the fungus could be seen on the snake skin. And so Dr. Lorch could look through the collection and he could visually analyze the specimen. Some of them he had to pull out of the fluid to look at them and examine them. But we have a card catalog that we still use today. We also have an electronic database that contains much of the information about the specimens, including some of those pathologies and other issues like the fungus that Dr. Lorch could see on the snakes.
And Jeff, can you just talk about the value of long-term research like this, not just for this particular snake fungus, but in general in understanding the evolution, I guess, or development or spread of diseases on all kinds of animals?
Right. Yeah. So like I said, you know, we sort of lack the ability often when there's a new disease to know exactly what's happening and to do that relatively quickly. And museums are really beneficial in being able to examine a large number of specimens that are held in one location. So we can really go through those pretty quickly. And the way in which these specimens are preserved in many museums actually do allow us to get DNA from them, like the snakes that were in the UW Zoology Museum collection, so that you can actually get these detections from animals that are pretty old. So without museums, we really wouldn't have a place to turn in order to do that. And, you know, with museums that have large numbers of specimens, it's not just when you first detect it, but you can actually look at those specimens and look at how, for example, the disease has changed over time, when it may have first arrived, how prevalent it is at different time periods. So it's really something that's invaluable to do this type of research.
And Laura, I don't know if members of the public would be looking at these snake fungi in particular, but are there things that members of the public can check out at your collection? I'm not check out in terms of taking them away from you, but look at.
Yeah, so we are primarily a research collection, and we do support teaching here on campus. We try to participate in university-sponsored outreach activities and make specimens available for schools and nature centers. So we try to reach out to the public as much as we can and make our specimens available to them.
Interesting. Laura, thanks a lot for joining us today.
Thank you.
And Jeff, thanks for sharing your research with us.
Thank you.
I've been talking to Laura Monahan, curator of collections at the University of Wisconsin Zoological Museum, and Jeff Lorch, microbiologist with the U.S. Geological Survey's National Wildlife Health Center in Madison. We talked to them about what's in that museum and how Jeff was able to use some of the specimens to research a fungus that's affecting an endangered snake species. Right now, it's time for Wisconsin Life. Here's producer Maureen McCollum with a tribute to Wisconsin Public Media's former director, Gene Purcell. He passed away in an accident this summer.
Gene Purcell dedicated almost his entire professional life to public media. His passion began in La Crosse, where he started as a student reporter at WLSU-FM, and through the decades, he worked his way up the ladder. Outside of work, Gene was a bit of a music nerd. He played guitar, collected thousands of albums, and restored an old jukebox. He also had a short stint in rock star management. Gene's sister Connie Purcell shares that story.
Many of you may not know, but in addition to all Gene's notable career accomplishments, he was also Pat Benatar's public relations guy for one night. It was a hot summer night in the early 80s. Gene and I were both living in La Crosse at the time. We decided we needed to beat the heat since neither of us had AC in our apartments. Gene suggested we meet at a smoky little neighborhood bar to shoot some pool and cool off with some refreshments. I'm all in. We met at the agreed upon place at the agreed upon time. This was an accomplishment in itself, as we were both too broke to afford a landline, and this was way, way before cell phones. So we're having a few, shooting some pool, and mostly minding our own business. A younger crowd came in. Soon they had us surrounded, and the commentary began. Is that Pat Benatar? What's she doing here? She has a concert tomorrow night. Will you sing for us? I was confused. I started looking around. I caught Gene's eye, and he gave me the hand across the throat gesture, the do not speak sign. Gene quickly summed up the current situation. He realized before I did that I had been mistaken for Pat Benatar. It may be hard to believe now, but back in the day, I was told I was a dead ringer for Pat Benatar. We had the same short dark hair and dark eyes, similar facial features, and a slight body build. That's where the similarities ended. Our voices were a certain miss. Gene is playing along. He is working the crowd. I heard someone say, "Brilliant idea, man. Hiding out with the locals. Our jig is up if I open my mouth." Not to worry, though. My big brother, the PR guy, calmed the masses and explained that I needed to rest my voice for the concert tomorrow night. There would be absolutely no conversation with Pat. This seemed to satisfy the crowd. I spent the rest of the night basking in our newfound and short-lived fame. I smiled happily, toasted our free drinks, and posed with my PR guy for photos with Pat's admirers. We shut down that little bar that night. We left with 1,000 well wishes and good luck at your concert from our fans. I'm happy to report we even had a little jingle still left in our pockets. I like to think all these years later, someone still recalls their chance encounter with Pat Benatar and her PR guy at some dive bar in La Crosse, Wisconsin. Rest in peace, big brother, in loving memory of Gene Purcell, also known as Pat Benatar's PR guy for one night.
That was Connie Purcell sharing a memory of her beloved brother, Gene Purcell. He was the former director of Wisconsin Public Media and passed away this summer. Connie dedicates that story to his wife, Ruth. Wisconsin Life is a co-production of Wisconsin Public Radio and PBS Wisconsin in partnership with Wisconsin Humanities. Additional support comes from Lowell and Mary Peterson of Appleton. I'm Maureen McCollum.
Coming up, seemingly everyday objects in our homes might reveal more about the world we live in than we think. We'll talk to a co-curator of a new exhibit that explores the political meaning of textile objects of the past. That's next year on Central Time. This is Central Time. I'm Rob Ferret. Have you ever thought of the everyday objects around your house as artifacts? A new exhibit on the UW-Madison campus takes everyday objects from households of the past and explores the political meaning of everyday textiles. Things like handkerchiefs, quilts, even the fabric used to make furniture. Marina Moskowitz is the Lynn and Gary Mecklenburg Chair in Textiles, Material Culture, and Design at UW-Madison. She's a professor in the Design Studies Department and co-curated the new exhibit called Politics at Home, Textiles as American History at the Ruth Davis Design Gallery. Marina, thanks a lot for joining us today.
Thanks so much for the invitation.
Before we take a look at the exhibit itself, I know you're interested in the material culture, the history behind what look like everyday objects. Can you talk about that a little and where that interest comes from?
Absolutely. So material culture is the study, really, of all of the things around us, the sort of material traces that people have left and continue to leave as markers of their time going through their daily lives. And I have a particular interest in textiles as one form of material culture. And I think, as you said so nicely in that introduction, textiles are just things that we interact with on not only a daily, but I would say probably a, you know, hourly, minutely, whatever you want to say, basis. You know, we wear them. Probably many of us right now are sitting down in a chair or in our car on some sort of textiles. Our feet might be on a carpet. You know, there are so many ways that we interact with these objects that a lot of the times we just don't even think about. And so one of the aims of the exhibit was to really pull out these objects of daily life and look at them closely and sort of think about all the messages that are encoded in them.
Right. And these are, and another thing about textiles is people often make them for themselves or for other people, too. What kind of messages, very explicit messages in some cases and maybe more subtle in others, what kind of messages do we see on the textiles in this exhibit?
Yeah, thanks. So all of the textiles in this exhibit draw from the Helen Louise Allen Textile Collection, which is a wonderful repository of about 13,000 textiles on campus in the School of Human Ecology. And they're kept right there on site. And so we really looked through and as you said, tried to find, you know, what are those messages? And when we really tried to think about the theme of American politics, sometimes it was very overt. So we have some objects. We have many objects in the show, actually, that have American eagles on them, as an example. Those start really from right around the turn of the 19th century when people were really trying to establish those American symbols. So we have some wonderful, for example, bedding pieces. So a coverlet, sort of like a bedspread, a woven piece that has on it eagles and the words, "United we stand, divided we fall." And you sort of think, well, gosh, would I put that on my bed today? You know, and those were the questions we were sort of always asking ourselves, is what does it mean to bring these messages into the home and into these very intimate spaces in the home? So those are some very overt messages. There's a amazing sort of World War I era silk pillowcase that has the words "America first." And then some imagery of soldiers and a rather sort of warlike-looking eagle carrying a flag. And again, you think, gosh, you know, what would it mean to sort of take those, in a way, very hard messages and put them on this, you know, very soft fiber that's very, you know, with a sheen and kind of very decorative. And there's just such an interesting juxtaposition there. But we also have some yeah, as you said, you know, more subtle evocations of what might be political. So, for example, one section of the exhibit looks at revival fabrics within the home. So these might be things, for example, from around the time of the bicentennial in the 1970s that reproduced domestic patterns from the colonial era or the early federal period. And we sort of ask, you know, what does that say if in the 1970s you chose to have in your home, for example, a pattern that came from a plantation house in the South? Isn't that a form of politics also, even though on the face of it you may just see, you know, a floral design or something like that? So yes, from the very overt to the very subtle, we really try to think about the different political messages that happen in the home.
How often are you able to connect this textile object with its creator or first owner? I imagine that is easier said than done sometimes.
That's very true. Yeah, we're quite lucky. You said earlier that, you know, a lot of textiles are made by people for people, and we can identify them. And there are examples of that in the exhibit where we know kind of exactly where this came from. A really wonderful example is a large quilt, and it's a form of quilt known as a crazy quilt, where there are sort of irregular shapes of different types of textiles that all come together in a very beautiful way. But a lot of the textiles that make up this quilt are political ribbons, so things that would have been worn, for example, by delegates at a political convention or a fraternal organization or something like that. And these date from the late 19th and early 20th century in Wisconsin. And one of my graduate students, Natalie Wright, has done a lot of research on this piece and has sort of confirmed the maker as being probably the wife of the mayor of Portage, Wisconsin in that time period, because his name, Edmund Baker, appears on one of the ribbons. So it's this very specific example where we can really trace people's civic lives through this very domestic object. There are other examples where we don't necessarily know the maker, or it's a manufacturer, really, you know, of, for example, furnishing fabric. And sometimes we do know wonderful family stories about how these pieces were used and come down to us. And sometimes we don't. But that's sort of part of the fun, is there's always more to learn.
Just in our last few moments, what's next for you with these items and after this exhibit?
Oh, yes, that's great. Well, you know, we really like to think of the exhibit not as an ending point, but really as the start of thinking about, well, you know, how can we continue to tell stories? What other stories can we tell? And so the Helen Louise Allen Textile Collection is a very global collection. But as we were working on this exhibit, we thought, well, the American holdings have some limitations, you know, in the stories that we're able to tell. And we're making a very active effort to collect pieces from groups of people who aren't as well represented in our collection. So the exhibition includes a couple of very recent acquisitions, for example, a Black Lives Matter T-shirt and a quilt that was made just last year in the Gee's Bend community in Alabama, which is a very traditional community of African-American quilt makers. So we're always trying to expand the ways in which we can tell stories of American history and also history of peoples around the globe.
Marina, thanks a lot for sharing this with us today.
Thank you so much.
Marina Moskowitz is the Lynn and Gary Mecklenburg Chair in Textiles, Material Culture, and Design at UW-Madison and a professor in the Design Studies Department. She co-curated the new exhibit called Politics at Home, Textiles as American History at the Ruth Davis Design Gallery. We've got links to info about that and how to check it out. You can find those links at WPR.org/Central Time.